Great to have you. Either way, that's great. And Open Doors work in many, many countries. You'll notice that we've started in the foyer there to put in areas of where our missionaries are, and we put a board up, a map on, and we're going to start developing that so and be opportunities for us to pray for people that are persecuted. Also outside, there's a little computer desk, and on there is some resources for the persecuted church. We would like them all to go today, for you to take them and to start reading and praying into those. So please make sure you take all those resources today. So Vaughan, we'll hand over to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the welcome, thank you for the invitation, and good to be with you. So I'm here representing Open Doors, but through them representing our brothers and sisters who face severe persecution. Thank you for letting me be with you again. One of my prized Christmas presents was a shiny new Tyndale commentary on the Gospel of Matthew. And so I couldn't wait on the Mount, that wonderful sermon that just reflects so much of the character of God in Jesus and the transforming power of his kingdom in this world. As I got into it, one of the verses I particularly wanted to read the commentary on, if we could have the next slide, please, is this one. Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I haven't come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. I don't know about you, that occasionally has kind of just given me a few kind of question marks, and I wanted to see what the commentary had to say about it. And I want to share really with you something of what the insights that I got from that, and particularly how the Sermon on the Mount can be seen in action in our brothers and sisters in the Middle East, which is what we're going to move on to. That particular comment that Jesus made about the law was probably made in response to accusations that the Jewish leaders would have levelled at him. He had regular clashes with them that we read of in the Gospels over his interpretation of the Jewish law. So there's no doubt they were out to say, you just come to try and abolish it all. And Jesus said, actually, no, I haven't. But I have come to give a radical new view. We all know that actually the New Testament does bring a whole new approach to God. It actually raises questions about our attitude to the Jewish law. And Jesus certainly brought some real changes in the way that he interpreted. And of course, the New Testament actually does tell us that we are free from the law once we've placed our lives in his hands through the redeeming power of what he did on the cross. So what is Jesus saying about the fulfillment of the law? The commentary explains that, a bit of Greek here, the Greek word pleromai, I'm not a Greek speaker, so that's where commentaries are really handy, in the hands of an expert. He said that the word really is talking about bringing something to its destined end, not in the end of being in the meaning of being terminated, but its destination. And he actually then goes on to give us a paraphrase, if we could have the next slide, please, of this whole section of the Sermon of the Mount, on the Mount. And this is what the commentator, J.T. France, says, how he rewrites it using his great knowledge of Greek. He says that Jesus is saying this: I have not come to set aside the Old Testament, but to bring the fulfillment to which it pointed. For no part of it can ever be set aside, but all must be fulfilled, as it is now being fulfilled in my ministry and teaching. So a Christian who repudiates any part of the Old Testament is an inferior Christian. The consistent Christian will be guided by the Old Testament and will teach others accordingly. And the next one, please, just to complete the paraphrase. But a truly Christian attitude is not the legalism of the scribes and Pharisees, but a deeper commitment to do the will of God. So the law was given to us as a kind of a a basic standard of justice, of good conduct, of attitude towards God and to fellow men. But Jesus is saying, none of that is taken away, but you now have the opportunity for a whole new interpretation of it. And then in the sermon, Jesus goes on, if we could have the next slide, please, to give some examples of what he means. He just elaborates on it, and he takes several examples of conduct. And I believe it's not an exclusive list of aspects of conduct. It's just some examples. And I'm going to come back to the one on murder at the end. So Jesus comments on adultery. He says, yeah, the Old Testament law permits permits divorce. you know that adultery is not permitted. Adultery is wrong. Jesus is saying, but there's a higher standard that I require of you, and that is to recognize it's not just about deed, it's about thought, it's about the imagination, it's about using lustful thoughts. In my eyes, in God's eyes, that is every bit as bad as carrying out adultery, a higher standard. Divorce. The Old Testament law permits divorce. Jesus is saying, I'm not coming to take away that permission, but I'm coming to raise the standard of our attitudes to marriage. And again, I don't want to be insensitive here to people who've gone through challenges in their marriage and difficulty. This is a serious issue for pastoral care. But what Jesus is saying is marriage in God's eyes is precious and to be preserved at all costs, even though the Old Testament law permits divorce. On oaths, Jesus is saying, you're encouraged to keep your oaths in the Old Testament law. I'm saying you don't even need to make oaths. Your word should be your word without swearing by anything else, a higher standard. You've heard in the Old Testament law about an eye for an eye. Yeah, that is a standard about just and appropriate and properly measured retribution. So punishment should not be higher or more severe than the crime calls for in the Old Testament law. But I'm saying there's a whole new standard that I'm asking you to carry out in response to those who hurt you, not asking for a retribution, but actually forgiveness. That is the value of the kingdom of heaven. Love for it's right to love your friends, those that are nice to you, and you can hate your enemies. I'm saying there's a higher standard required by the kingdom of heaven, which is that you love your enemies and you pray for them. And then Jesus makes this really outrageous statement, which I've put at the bottom of the list there. It comes at the end of chapter 5. Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Wow, what a demand. Now, we know that is not actually possible to live out. I don't know about your theology. My theology does not say that God expects me to be perfect, even though Jesus is saying, be perfect. Therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. The New Testament makes it clear that we will fail. Even the Apostle Paul says, the things I want to do, I don't do them. I let God down all the time. In making this statement, Jesus was acknowledging our weaknesses. But he sets the bar high and says, this is what I want you to aim for. In the prophetic exhortation we had earlier on, we were reminded of that scripture that everyone who has the hope of seeing Jesus wants to be like him and purifies himself, purifies herself. And it reflects the Old Testament law in which God said, be holy even as I am holy. Not saying it's easy, not saying that, but there's a high standard that we are called on to aim for. Now, I'm going to go back to that one at the top of the list, and I'll tell you why, I'll explain why I've left it to last. Again, we all know murder is wrong. The Old Testament law says you do not murder. That is not allowed. Jesus says, I'm setting the bar much higher. You all know that. I'm saying, if you, as a Christian, call another person a fool in God's eyes, that is the same as murder. God's standard is incredibly high, and that's the level he's asking us for us to aim for in our behavior. So I'm meditating on all this. I'm praying, Lord, help me to live by your standards. Please help me to really absorb this and make it part of my life. Later that day, I'm out in the car, and I think I might, I don't know if when I've preached here before, I've talked about how when God's challenging me about conduct, it often happens in the car. Do you know what I mean? You know, there's something about when we're behind a steering wheel that our true self, or maybe a self that we're not proud of, can come out. So I'm driving down this narrow road, long narrow road, cars parked on either side. So to get from one end to the other, you've got to have give and take. So I'm being a very polite driver. Someone's coming towards me. There's a place, space on the left. I pull in, let them pass. I expect people coming the other way. If there's a space on the right, expect them to pull in and I'll pass. And we make a fair bit of progress like that. And then as I'm getting towards the end, this hothead is driving towards me at full speed, gesticulating and mouthing. And there's a space on the right where I stop to let him pull in, assuming he's going to do that, so I can pass on. No, he expects to drive straight through, and he's mouthing and gesticulating at me, but he realizes there's another car behind me, so I can't go back, so he's got to do the sensible thing and pull into this space to my right. As you do so, he's still mouthing off. So I look at him as he draws near to me, and I say, "You plonker." Am I allowed to say that in church? And of course, did that help? Of course not. He winds his window down, and as I move on, there's a loud bang as he uses something to have a little go at my car, and I move on, feeling, no, I didn't handle that very well. What I've been reading in the scripture early that day comes back to my mind. You know that funny word that it says, if you call somebody raka, that's the same as murder. Well, I think raka is the equivalent of the modern day plonker. And I called him raka. So I had grieved God. Now, in a sense, I'm sure a lot of you are sympathizing with me. I hope maybe you are. That I was behaving quite reasonably. And this hothead was not. So I was justified in what I said. But by God's standard, God setting the bar higher and saying, you may feel justified in it, but my standard is you don't behave like that, however well you feel justified in doing it. It then brought my thoughts back, if we can have the next slide, please, to the actual Beatitudes that we're all so familiar with, which actually explain exactly for us the standard that God is calling for in this radical teaching of Jesus about our conduct. Now, we haven't got time today because I want to move on to our brothers and sisters in the Middle East. We haven't got time to look at these in detail, but I want to make a comment again, with the benefit of my reading of the commentary, about this word blessed or blessed, whichever way you pronounce it. When we talk about being blessed, it can mean lots of different things. And there is a Greek verb that talks about the blessing of God in our lives, that to change things for the better. When you read the Beatitudes, do you think that this is what God is saying? So, blessed are the poor in spirit, because I'm actually going to make them rich in spirit. I'm going to change things for the better. Blessed are those that mourn, they will be comforted. I'm going to make things better. Blessed are the meek, I'm going to make things different. I'm going to set you free from being meek, and you can actually be much more self-assertive. Now, the Greek word for blessed is not in that sense of God's blessing. When the New English Bible was issued decades ago, a lot of us as evangelicals were a bit scandalized by its modern language and its liberal interpretation. And in the Beatitudes, it used the word happy. And we all thought, oh, typical liberal thinking. It's taking God out of it, taking God's blessing, saying happy are the meek, happier. But actually, my commentator tells me that that is actually a correct translation. It isn't referring to God's blessing to change. Certainly, it's talking about the consequences in God's hands of behaving in these ways. But it's not, Jesus is not saying, I want you to be different. The word means happy, or even this is a good place to be. So when he's talking about, even on mourning, he's saying this is a good place to be. He's not talking about bereavement. He's not talking about the grief in bereavement. He's talking about an attitude, a God-given attitude that looks at the world and grieves in the way that Jesus did when he looked at Jerusalem and cried, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I just long to gather you like a hen gathers its chicks and to change things for you to understand my message and my heart for you. That's the kind of, and Jesus is saying, that's a good place to be. So he's saying it's a good thing to be meek. It's a good thing to be poor in spirit. Those are not attitudes that are generally valued, the values of the culture that we live in. And we will be accused if we say that that is God's will for us, that we are just laying down and letting people treat us like doormats. And that's not something that I feel particularly inclined to do. But we have to interpret what Jesus is saying here about being meek and poor in spirit in the way that he, to try and grasp his heart for our conduct and the way that it will impact the world around us. just could have the next slide, please, again. So no time to go in detail, but Jesus is talking about it's a good thing to be merciful, pure in heart, peacemakers. Now, these are the things that I, as a representative, our brothers and sisters in the Middle East, those persecuted brothers and sisters, want to see in my life, and I'm so grateful when I see it demonstrated in their life. We have the next slide, please. So you will have seen this before when I've spoken. This is the hot off the press, the 2017 version, the list of the top 10 countries where Christians are persecuted the most. Again, no time to go into these in any detail. Today we're going to focus on 6 and 7, Syria and Iraq. Others, no great changes, other than Pakistan has now leapt up the list because of the amount of atrocities carried out against Christians there. Some encouraging news in response to our prayers for Pakistan. Somebody drew this to my attention this morning. So thank you for keeping your ears to the ground. But in Pakistan, the legislature is actually, there's a committee that's been set up on human rights, which is rethinking the way that the infamous blasphemy laws, which are used against Christians, are being implemented. It's a start. We don't know what the outcome will be, but what they're saying, they are recommending that the law should at least allow for an investigation before Christians are held in custody. At the moment, in Pakistan, if a Muslim says, I heard my neighbours just blaspheming against Muhammad or Allah, then that word counts double in the law, the word of a Christian, and the Christian will be arrested and face the possibility of the death penalty. So thank God that things are moving in that direction. Please keep praying. Next slide, please. before we look at a few more examples, I just want to, again, just look at what Jesus is saying here about the effect of our behaviour and the consequences of that in our world if we do live according to the principles of the Sermon on the Mount. You'd be very familiar with what Jesus is saying about being salt and light. In other words, what he's saying is, do something to change the flavour of the culture you live in. Be visible in being different. He's not saying that, you know, you're going to see people flocking to be like you, to learn from you, to come into church. But what he's saying is you will make a difference. And just thinking about the consequences of my behavior when I miss an opportunity, not to call someone a plonker, but just to try and be a peacemaker. Every time we do that, we make a little difference. We just cause people to double take. That wasn't the response they expected. They expect aggression. We just do something for the kingdom of heaven by being salt and light. Next slide, please. So I don't know if you've ever seen, I think you've seen something of the Open Doors film about the Middle East. So you might recognise Pastor Edward and his wife from that film. I just want to tell you a little bit about their story to encourage you to pray for Christians in Syria. Was anybody at the ICC in Birmingham 13, 14 months ago when Open Doors had a day conference? I'm misleading you. There was another pastor I referred to last year, I mentioned from Iraq. Pastor Edward and his wife actually came to Birmingham to a smaller meeting last February. It was a tremendous privilege to meet them and to hear their story. So I'm going to give you this as an example of how our prayers are making a difference. So they live in Syria. You don't need me to tell you what's going on in Syria. It's on your news almost every day, apart from being superseded by what's going on in America at the moment. But, you know, Syria is just such a bloodbath, such a nightmare place to live in. Imagine being a Christian. The amazing thing is, I don't know if you realise this, but in all that violence and bombing and killing that's going on in Syria, and those pictures of little children being dragged from the rubble, the people who are actually being caught up in that the most are Muslims. Christians are, of course. If you're a Christian, whoever's there is caught up in it. But that violence is targeted more Muslim against Muslim because of the different factions in the Middle East. Christians do get caught up in it. Pastor Edward is a Syrian, but hasn't lived in Syria all his life. He trained as a dentist. And as a dentist, he therefore got the opportunity to go and work abroad. And he moved over to the United States and had a very comfortable life. Thank you very much. Freedom, wealth, good clientele, doing very well. He's raised his family there. And then heard God say very distinctly to him, "I want you back in Syria." Imagine that. You know, you're living in comfort. You know what's going on in Syria. And God calls you back there. He went back to be a pastor of a church in Damascus. And all around him, one day an incendiary bomb actually fell on his apartment right next to the central heating oil storage and miraculously did not explode and he was spared. But he's that close all the time to the violence. He speaks in a church which is just full of people who are walking the streets of Damascus past devastated buildings and facing that kind of violence. He was obedient to that call to go and give up his wealth and be poor in spirit. Poor in spirit isn't just talking about material wealth. It's talking about an attitude of meekness. But he chose to live that life of being poor in spirit, to be obedient. How's God using him? Well, Open Doors, you probably know, have been used very powerfully in supporting our brothers and sisters in Syria and Iraq who are facing incredible hardship, losing their opportunities to work, living really in abject poverty. And so we are able to channel aid into our brothers and sisters. And Pastor Edward and his wife Rana and their church are very much at the hub, at the centre of that aid distribution. I think I mentioned the pastor with a similar story in Iraq last year when I was here, and how they being used and being obedient to the call of God in their area means that incredible transformation takes place. So I've talked about how Muslims are getting caught up in that violence. That's causing many Muslims to say, how is this right? What does this say about Islam? What does this say about our understanding of Allah? That all this violence is carried out against us. And then, because Christians are receiving aid that we in this country are forwarding to them, they are carrying out the values of the kingdom of heaven and sharing what they have with their neighbours, be they Christian or Muslim. And many Muslims are coming to the point of saying, there's something different here from what we understood about Christianity. Pastor Edward now leads a church which was decimated by the violence, many of his congregation having to leave the country leave the area to go to live in refugee camps. But that decimation has been totally replaced by Muslims coming to faith in Jesus because of the values of the kingdom of heaven being demonstrated through our prayers and our giving to support our brothers and sisters. Just move on to the next slide. It'll go very quickly through some images of Syria, which you'll be familiar with, the devastation. This is a picture of aid distribution through the church. And this is a picture of a church that's full of believers in Damascus. Many of them, perhaps even the majority, from Muslim backgrounds come in to believe in Jesus Christ. Thank God he is building his church and his kingdom is reigning through his kingdom. Can we have the next slide, please? It did move on. I think I mentioned Pastor Farouk. You wouldn't have seen his picture last time, but Pastor Farouk is in Iraq, has a very similar story of having left the country in Saddam Hussein's time to train. He wasn't allowed to. There was no theological training opportunity in Iraq. So he moved to Australia, where he had that opportunity to train, liked it very much in Australia and decided to stay. And just as Pastor Edward heard that call of God to go back, Pastor Farouk got the same call back into the nightmare and the violence of the Middle East, and again was obedient. God is blessing him. And he also leads a church of 300 people, right in the centre of Baghdad, the majority of whom are Muslims who've come to faith. Please pray for our brothers and sisters. It's wonderful to see God blessing them in that way, but that doesn't minimise the risks and the danger that they face, and they rely on our prayers to sustain them through what they're going through. The next one, yes, right. This now is a picture bringing us up to date with what's going on in Iraq. I want you to just think about what life is like in Iraq. You're probably aware that the Iraqi forces, the Iraqi government, has made some substantial progress in kicking Islamic State, so-called Islamic State, out of some of the territory that they took. And so there are towns and villages which are being freed. The battle goes on. It will be a long fight, and IS won't give up easily. So we've got areas now which were traditionally Christian, which have been taken over by Islamic State, and Christians in those areas will have actually lived an absolute nightmare if they didn't escape. There would have been torture and killing and absolute atrocities that they will have witnessed. Many of them who did escape went to refugee camps. Those areas are now being set free little by little. Great news. So we've got pictures of church leaders. This is one of the. This is going to be a Catholic church where the church leaders are able to go back, but to find the church has been devastated. Can we have the next one, please? So pictures of church worshippers, priests gathering with members of the armed forces in the churches that have been liberated. And the next one, please. Pictures of a cross being re-erected on the roof. Now, without making any value judgments about the Catholic Church, I want you to think what it's like to be in that sort of situation. There will be people in those churches who love Jesus, who are devoted followers of Jesus. There will be many others who are what we might call cultural Christians, people who are Christian in name but don't have that personal walk with Jesus. And they are going to face a particular challenge going back into areas where this kind of devastation has taken place. Please, will you pray for the church in Iraq, that God will pour out his spirit on those who are nominal Christians, that they will uphold the values of the kingdom of heaven. Imagine what it's like going back from a refugee camp into your village, really thrilled to be going home. You're walking up the street, see your house in the distance, and you see washing hanging on the line. And you think, whose washing is that? Your neighbour has moved in. Your neighbour is a Muslim, it's a Muslim family. They were actually really pleased to see you got rid of because they didn't want Christians in the neighbourhood anyway. So they've just taken the opportunity to move into your house, which was nicer than theirs. How do you feel? How do you deal with that situation? There are going to be enormous challenges for Christians, whether they be nominal Christians or passionate followers of Jesus in Iraq. Can we have the next one, please? Okay, another similar picture of a cross going up. And the next one, please. Open doors, again, just to draw things to a close. Open doors never set out to be an aid organisation per se. Our history has been one of partnering with persecuted Christians, finding out their particular need and aiming to meet it. Whether traditionally you know about smuggling Bibles into places where Bibles weren't allowed, enabling Bible training for church leaders, helping people to get into education where they were discriminated against, even helping people to get into employment through aid in that way. Open Doors has had to become an aid organisation on a big scale because of what's going on in the Middle East. So we are currently supporting over 20,000 both in Iraq and in Syria. Thank you for your generous support in that, but please consider being a generous giver for the future and a prayer partner with us. Whether you feel called to do that or not, please just remember when you see Iraq and Syria mentioned on the news to pray for our brothers and sisters in these circumstances. The picture that's on the screen at the moment is showing one of the ways that we're particularly targeting financial aid to help people get re-established in business in the mess that now exists both in Iraq and Syria. So microloans of up to £5,000 are being given to individuals to help them become independent. And praise God, being Christians, they pay those loans back. So it means that the money can be recycled. That is a crucial area of helping the Christian community in Iraq to get re-established. And the next one, please. So, just to finish, will you please support our persecuted brothers and sisters by signing our petition? I know many of you have done this. Open Doors currently have a campaign to get signatures to present to our own government and to the United Nations, asking them to use what power they do have to do what they can to guarantee or help guarantee religious freedom for minorities in the Middle East. I can explain more about that. I'll be at the back of the hall there with some more copies of that petition if you haven't signed it. Thank you for listening, and please keep on praying.